Welcome back to The Mystical Positivist. I'm your host, Stuart Gudnick, joined in the studio by co-host Rob Schmidt. In the second hour of our show, Rob Schmidt and I will continue our conversation with Eric Edelman, a teacher in the lineage of the great French spiritual teacher Arnaud Desjardins, who with his wife Sophie operates Ashram Mangalam in Quebec, Canada. Since Desjardins founded it 20 years ago, Eric and his wife Sophie have operated it, the Ashram Mangalam, bringing Desjardins' work to North America. All right, so before the break, you mentioned something rather provocative, which was a quote from Swami Prajnanpad, who is your teacher's teacher, about emotion. I wondered if we could pick up the conversation from there.
Yes, yes. So the quote is very provocative because it says, emotion is never justified.
Emotion is never justified.
Yeah, which is a big deal.
Yeah.
That is a big deal.
Well, particularly since people often, you know, and particularly people who have psychological training and have been through therapy often are taught that their emotions are justified, or that they need to get in touch with their emotions because that's their true nature.
Or even more, that emotions are actually the locus of who we are and what we are.
Yes, right.
So emotions are never justified. So how do you understand that statement?
I don't say that I have no more emotions, but it's very important to understand the origin of the emotions, because it starts at the beginning from a denial of what is as it is. That is, the mind is creating a second. And this superposition brings you in a complete false reaction. And there is always a thought at the beginning, at the origin. And this thought is something like, it should not be like that.
Right.
So
it's always false, because it's not the coincidence with reality as it is. It's something which the mind adds to reality, a denial. It wants to put something else which is not possible.
So the beginning of an emotion is a thought, whether we recognize it or not, that is a denial of what is happening.
Yes, but we don't acknowledge this thought. It's very quick, and we cannot put the hand on it. But what we feel is the consequence of this, which is a physiological and emotional perturbation.
Yes, so the perturbation lasts much longer than the thought which begins begins this process.
Yes, yes.
And
so we start with we feel the perturbation, but this perturbation is because the body is in a crisis, in a possibility, because we cannot put something different of what is in the moment. We can change in time. If we want to change things, we can change them. But in the moment, it's absolutely impossible to interfere with the reality in the moment. And the mind always tries to interfere.
So the mind is creating crises all the time.
The mind is creating a second, that is, another reality, which does not exist.
Yes.
But just to add to the provocativeness of this teaching, is it the case that this applies for positive emotions as well as negative emotions?
Right, right. But it's a very difficult point to understand. All emotions are in this category, even positive emotions.
So,
sorry.
Well, yeah, let's delve into that. If I am happy about something that's just happened, let's say I get a promotion at work, and
yes.
I'm happy.
Yes.
Tell me what the thought is that begins that emotion.
Yes, the thought behind is it could not have been, it could not have happened.
So the thought, I see, the thought is the it couldn't happen, and so because
yes.
it happened, I feel lucky, or I feel like I have
right,
gotten away with something.
Yes, exactly. It's a comparison.
A judgment.
A judgment, a comparison with something. Of course, it has happened, but you are not happy in the emotional manner. You are not happy because it happened. You are happy. This positive emotion only comes because there is behind the hidden comparison.
Got it.
Which is very difficult to catch.
Yes, absolutely.
And a negative emotion comes from the other face of the coin, but it's the same process.
It's easier, in some senses, to work with the negative emotions because at least people realize there's a problem, right?
Yes, yes. In fact, we want to be free from negative emotions, but we would like to keep the positive ones.
Indeed.
So the you made a distinction before the break, though, that between emotion and feeling.
Yes.
So you've talked about emotion in this as starting with a thought and being arising out of a judgment or a denial of reality.
Right.
Can
yes.
you describe now how a feeling is different?
The feeling is from the heart also, but not the negative part. It's the upper part, we could say, of the emotional center. And it's always positive. It's always positive. It cannot be subject to the opposite. So it's very difficult because when we speak about love, for example, it depends if we speak about emotional love, attachment, or
mm-hmm.
if we speak about infinite love, which could not become hate also or something like that. It's not possible. It's just an infinite positive feeling with no opposition. For example, compassion, peace, all these feelings are this kind of description, this kind of feelings.
So would it be fair to say that the mark of a natural feeling is the lack of grasping?
Yes. It's always positive, which is not the case with the emotions, because there could be ambivalence, or the emotion turn the opposite way very quickly, but for the feelings, it's not possible. If it's peace, it's not a peace which depend from outside circumstances.
So, in a sense, it's a natural arising in the emotional center, unconditioned by the action of thought.
Yes, 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 right. But it's possible when the emotion starts to disappear, so the upper part of the heart starts to flourish, to grow, in fact.
And is it the case that most people in the ordinary psychological existence that we grow up in have limited access to feeling, but have lots of access to emotion.
Yes, unfortunately, yes.
So
that's why many people suffer, because we are trapped in all the emotional energies, and even if we are doing a psychological work, it helps, of course, but if we don't understand the real meaning of the emotion and why emotions appear, we cannot be free from them, because we have not the path and we have not the way to go through them and to use their energy to transcend.
So that's why it's so important to understand the negation, that crucial negating thought that starts the process of producing emotion. Because if you don't see that, you're not going to be able to distinguish between an emotion and a feeling.
Yes.
That's very clear.
But the main work of the mind, in the sense we use it, that means manas in Sanskrit, which is a very technical term in the Vedanta approach. This mind creates a second, and from this, all the emotions start. So, if you can go back to this origin and suppress, in a way, the no, immediately the emotional energy starts to vanish, to express and vanish.
Is it a function of suppression, or is it simply a function of recognizing choice?
You speak about the no?
Yeah, the no.
The no is like a kind of reflex, which comes from a very long time ago. It's a strong habit in our inner structure and psychological constitution.
So when we see it, we have the choice in the future to recognize it and not to activate it.
Yes, of course. Yes. We have to go against the habit to say no when it happens. You know, it's very quick. For example, you let a glass falling on the floor, and the first reflex could be no. It should not have happened.
Right.
So we have to be quicker than this reflex, conditioned reflex.
Yes. So the metaphor that I've sometimes seen is about watering seeds. There's the seed that generates the thought that says no, this should not have happened, as opposed to the seed of opening to the spaciousness of what is actually happening. Mm-hmm. And so it is an interesting an aspect of practice, where, because you're saying that it happens very, very quickly. This certainly corresponds to my own understanding as well. And so to be able to effectively address this requires a lot of practice to get quick enough.
Right.
To be able to recognize what's about to happen.
Yes, exactly. But the emotion is the alarm, in a way. The emotion is a sign that there is a denial somewhere.
So
like in your car, when there is an alarm, that means something is going wrong.
Yes.
That's interesting. So part of the training is to recognize emotions as alarms and to immediately, in the presence of emotion, turn our attention to the root.
Yes, exactly. Because that means that you don't see anymore reality. You just interpret reality at the time.
Yes. And then that interpretation can become a story with enormous inertia to it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That's why it takes a long time to work on this.
Right.
And the inertia of habits is amazing.
And as we were speaking before the break, the practice of lines is one method or one course of practice for dealing with some of the deeper conditioned knows that impact our experience.
Yes, and yes, exactly. And to learn, to start to learn, to stop denying, and to be in just what is as it is, even if it comes from the past, because when you live it again, it's in the present moment.
Yes.
Even if it's about past experience, you live them again in the present moment.
Right.
And at that time, you say unconditionally yes to this, and so you reverse the inertia of habit. That means the denial, the no about all the experience, so, which was qualified as unpleasant or very painful.
So we don't deny our past, but we simply accept the facts of our past without creating an interpretation one way or the other.
Got it. Yes. So the work of Ashram Mangalam is something that you has been the center of your life, I assume, for quite a while now. 20 years, you said?
Yes, 20 years, yes.
Can you tell us how that happened, what that was like when your teacher asked you to undertake to do this kind of work?
Mm-hmm. The way it happened, you mean?
The way it happened and how you responded to it.
Yes.
maybe what feelings arose and what emotions arose.
yes. you know that before I was in Paris and I was leading lines with people during 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was following the advice and the instruction Arnaud was giving me, so he asked me to help people in line process. So I was doing this during 9 years, and after he was wishing me to open a center in France. So I tried, but it was not successful. I don't start even. I don't find houses. I don't find a way. There were many obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a group of Quebecan people, because Arnaud went in Quebec a long time ago, and he has a little group of people who were some disciples, and they were reading his books, and each year he was spending 10 days among them. And so as I had a lot of obstacles to find a way to open the center in France, one morning I received a phone call from Veronique,
Arnaud's wife. Yes.
And she says to me, "What do you think about Canada?" Because we had just a discussion with Arnaud and a Quebecan woman, and they asked someone to stay with them in Quebec. I was very surprised, but I say yes immediately, but I don't know at the time to what I was saying yes.
That makes sense.
It was like Woody Allen who says, yes, but can you repeat the question? So I was saying yes, but I understood after that what was the consequences. But in fact, it was a very great and marvelous benediction. And so I jumped into this new adventure, which was very difficult and on many levels. And I was in a little house, not in Mangalam first, but in a little house, in a little farm near Quebec City, but It was winter and 50 degrees under zero centigrade and very difficult.
quite different from any place in France, weather-wise.
Ah, yes. Yes. You know, when you open your freezer, you receive warm, you know.
That's funny.
So I met very difficult circumstances, but it helped me to qualify more myself and to gain some maturity. And so after 2 years we change and we find a beautiful place near Vermont border. We are just at 300 meters from the Vermont border.
Ah.
In the hills, and so we start this new adventure, and it was like the first ashram of Arno, something like that. Very, very little ashram with a few people, and so we can work deeply during several weeks.
So in other words, the way it works is how you were describing your own experience earlier in your working with Arno. Then, so people come to the ashram for various retreats and that sort of thing?
Yes, yes. They come for a weekend to 4 weeks. You know, it depends. Yes.
Do you
come regularly.
Do you have any permanent residence?
No. I'm just here as a permanent with my wife, Sophie. And there are some benevolent people who came to help and very generous people. Give their time and to help us to support this place. So they are very generous and dedicated.
How wonderful! So I've seen the picture on your website.
Yes.
And it's a lovely a lovely building, and the view of the Vermont mountains.
Yes, right.
Is very appealing. So when people come for retreats, they will. Does your group do sitting meditation forms, that sort of thing? Do they do in addition to lyings and other practices?
Yes, we have just half an hour meditation each morning, and I encourage people for lying or for sitting. It's always private in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have some teaching sessions two or three times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And people receive also some teaching from Arno on CDs. There are registration of some Arno's teaching on different kind of subjects. And they participate during the day to, we call it Seva, which is the time of work. In the wood or in the house, and so it's regularly every day almost the same thing in a routine, ashram routine.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple.
Got it. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. Today, co-host Rob Schmidt and I continue our conversation by telephone with Eric Edelman, student and colleague of the great French spiritual teacher Arno Desjardins, who with his wife Sophie operates Ashram Mangalam in Quebec, Canada. So is the do you have a mix of French speakers and English speakers who come to the ashram, or are the programs primarily given in French?
The main people who came come from Quebec and France, but sometimes, yes, we have some American, a few are English speaking language from Mexico, for example, because there is a group of Arno students there, so they came regularly so here. But mainly it's in French, and when they are English language, I try my best to to express my very bad English.
Your English is wonderful, so. But I'm on that note, I'm wondering if you have considered plans for translating any of your own books into English.
I have no I have no plan about that, you know, I don't know.
It's interesting because Swami Prajnanpad was Indian and spoke English, and yet most of the books about him and most of the work available is all in French. So it's ironic.
Yes.
But one thing that we touched on earlier and I'm interested in going back to is the connection with Arnaud and the traditional Fourth Way. You mentioned that he had participated in Fourth Way groups at a time when Madame de Saltzman was leading the groups.
Yes.
And so there's a strong sensibility and connection with the Fourth Way work. And you had mentioned in a conversation that we had prior to the interview that, in fact, you know, part of Arnaud's recommendation was that you study and look through some of Nicole's material on the psychological commentaries.
Yes. Which is classic Fourth Way literature, for those who don't know.
And so I'm interested in your perspective on how you see the Fourth Way work in terms of the work that you do. Is it a similar voice? Are there some distinctions?
Mainly it's a similar voice. The amazing thing is that among the French disciple of Swami Prajnanpad, there was a Frenchman who was working with Gurdjieff himself during 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And he was speaking about Gurdjieff to Swami Prajnanpad.
Really?
And Swami Prajnanpad was very fond. He says, I would like very much to meet this man. He was very interested by what he was hearing from his French disciple about Gurdjieff.
Hmm.
And Swami Prajnanpad was not even interested to meet, for example, Mahananda Mahima. But he was very interested to meet, if it was possible, to meet Gurdjieff.
Interesting.
And the interesting thing is that, for example, when I read Maurice Nicol, the first page, it was said that your being attracts your life.
Yeah.
And for me, it was I acknowledged this sentence from Arnaud through Swami Prajnanpad, and I said to Arnaud, "Oh, it's the same as Swami Prajnanpad. Gurdjieff says the same as Swamiji." And Arnaud was laughing because he tells the story that his French students report to Swamiji this Gurdjieff sentence, and Swamiji take it for himself. Your being attracts your life.
It's the highest form of flattery.
That's very funny. The material is interesting, and the Fourth Way material is very interesting. One element that I see in some Fourth Way organizations that I definitely do not see in Arnaud Desjardins' students and at Hauteville, his ashram in France, is Fourth Way people can be very serious. And sometimes there is a sense that it's not possible to achieve a real change, but that we must try hard anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there's a feeling of lightness and a feeling of expansiveness that I see in Arnaud's work, and that's something that's we appreciate very much, and that is one distinction that I see with Fourth Way teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's what we've seen is the people working decades after Gurdjieff's death, and we were fortunate enough to actually meet Arnaud one time before his he died. So it may not be a fair comparison, but I mean, an example is another one of your colleagues, Gilles Farset,
yes,
wrote a very irreverent book called The Anti-Wisdom Manual.
Yes, yes.
Which is very funny and, mm-hmm, and yet accurate at the same time about, mm-hmm, many of the pitfalls of the spiritual process.
Mm-hmm.
So that lightness that Stuart's talking about is, and expansiveness, and sense that actually people can accomplish something real.
Oh yes.
Is very important and not necessarily always present for folks in the fourth way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's been your experience of the fourth way directly. If you've had much contact with people in the fourth way.
Yes, I have some friend who was spending a lot of time in the groups in Paris, and mm-hmm, we had a lot of discussion about all this different approach, mm-hmm, which is very fascinating. It's very interesting, and from Arnaud, I hear a lot of reference about Gurdjieff, not only stories, but the way he was working with people and his teaching. And Arnaud was studying a lot of Gurdjieff's teaching. He was reading, for example, 6 times In Search of the Miraculous.
Yeah.
And until the end of his life, he was reading again Maurice Nicol and Gurdjieff's material. And I was wondering why he was reading again all this, but he was very, very connected, deeply connected with this approach. And so for me, it's very similar with Swami Prabhupada's approach. It's very close, mm-hmm, yeah, spiritually close.
Did you ever visit India yourself and see if Swami Prajnanpad had already passed away, and see his ashram there and any students remaining there?
No, I went in India after his death, unfortunately. When I met Arnaud for the first time, it was just the end of Swami Prajnanpad's life. He,
yes,
was dying 3 months after.
Ah.
I never met you, though.
Got it.
No.
Well, it's one of the things that we have been touched by in our work, because at Tayu Meditation Center we strive to avail ourselves to make use of the work of other traditions and teachings.
Yeah,
During the break, you mentioned briefly something that we have found to be a wonderful resource for English speakers, and that's,
yeah,
and that's a series of DVDs called A Festival of Newness that was filmed in Montana, I believe,
yeah,
at the ashram of Purna Steinitz.
Yes, yeah, right.
And it's all Arnaud either speaking or responding to questions as well. But the luminosity that you mentioned encountering in 1974 and after is fully on display in these DVDs that I believe would have been like around 2006 or 7.
Yes,
2007, when these recordings were made, and they are, an incredible tool and testimony to the kind of teaching that Arnaud was still vigorously capable of offering at that,
yes, yes,
at that advanced, relatively advanced age. I guess he would have been something like 80 years old at that point. We want to make sure, we will be putting a link on our website for people who listen to this interview, so English speakers can find and make use of that resource. And also for the two books of Arnaud's published in English that I mentioned earlier, we'll also put some information about those on the website as well. And we're if it's acceptable to you, we will also put a link to your website at Ashram Mangalam. And I noticed that you had a book that apparently talks about what, at least from the title, translated into English, sounds like is your experience of the trajectory of doing of creating this resource for people in North America. Is that true?
I don't. Can you repeat, sorry, this last question?
Because yes, I'm wondering if the title of one of your books on your website, when Google translates it into English, makes it seem as if that book is about your experience of running Ashram Mangalam. Is that true?
This book, Mangalam, is my years of study with Arnaud and the way he was guiding me.
Ah, so the way he guided you to help run to run Ashram Mangalam. You mean?
Not to run Ashram Mangalam, but to run myself.
Ah,
so
okay,
it's your spiritual autobiography.
Yes, something like that. Yes.
Ah, okay, wonderful. Well. You have two fans here who would love to see those books translated into English, and there's nothing compulsory about it, but just wanted to mention that.
Yes.
Especially since you're so close to the Vermont border.
Yes.
Exactly.
So, I'm interested to know now from your perspective. Since Arnaud died in 2011, how you see his community and all of the teachers that he's produced taking this work forward?
Yes. Fortunately, he was taking care of us really before he died, and he was very precise about what he wants after his death. And so his two ashrams here in Quebec, Mangalam, and in France, Hauteville. So we continue in a very good atmosphere and disposition, and we continue this specific teaching, which is very precious for a lot of people here. So we continue... The heritage, we say?
Yes.
Swami Prajnanpad's heritage. And these two ashrams are still alive and full of this energy of Arnaud, our master.
Well, Arnaud was... One very impressive thing to me was how clear he was about putting people in place to teach,
yes. To
carry forward the work.
Yes.
I'm interested to know if has the community yet had a teacher trained by one of Arnaud's students? In other words, a student that, or a teacher that was produced by one of the teachers that Arnaud produced.
No, not yet.
I'm sure that time will come.
We are not yet in this new generation. I hope so, but we never know. It's in God's hands.
Yes, indeed.
And yet, as I said, the quality and the clarity of the teachers, or as Arnaud called them, colleagues, is a very impressive aspect of his work and his legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that Veronique, his wife, continues as well to continue her husband's work. And I think she had a unique perspective on what he was doing, from what I understand. And that certainly seemed evident to me when we met her as well. Is that your experience too?
Yes, she was. She was wearing in her own body and essence Arnaud's energy. Hmm. And we don't know yet the way she will teach. It's not precise now. We don't know exactly. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that she was wearing in herself a very great clarity and a very nice spiritual energy. So, and there are other students of Arnaud who teach in Hauteville and are wearing also this same energy.
Got it.
There are a few, just a few.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the last thing I'll mention, and it's another thing that I sympathize with and admire very much about our experience at Hauteville when Stuart and I visited there about 6 or 7 years ago, I think.
Yes, yes.
Was the prominence of the reverence. A prominent reverence for other spiritual teachings.
Oh yes, yes.
And maybe you could just as we come to the conclusion here, you could talk just a little bit about Arnaud's and your own views about that.
Yes, it was a specificity of Arnaud that he was admiring many sages and masters from different traditions, mm-hmm. and so. He even studied with several of them, and this reverence, it's not even tolerance, because it's more a feeling of unity at the level of the essence. So in Hauteville, for example, there are some sanctuaries, different, there is a little mosque, a Christian chapel, a Tibetan shrine, and all this. But it's not syncretism, it's in fact a deep reverence and a profound admiration for the other masters and lineage. And so it's very important, it was very important for Arnaud. And so it's in this spirit that we continue to be in contact as much as possible with Sufi, Chir Sufi, or Tibetan Rinpoche or other teacher, and I would like to continue, even for my own benefit, to meet teachers like you, for example, and other teacher and spiritual lineage holders. So it's very rich and nourishing to find people who follow other paths.
I completely agree, and I'll just add that. When we first saw you speak in Arizona at the ashram of Lee Loswick after he passed away, we felt an immediate sense of both reverent appreciation and kinship, even in the way you spoke, and that has only been deepened by this conversation we've had today. So thank you very much.
I thank you both of you also, and. Because it's a spiritual friendship, and it's very nourishing for me. And I thank you also very much for this gift.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on the show and joining us for The Mystical Positivist. This has been a delightful conversation and nourishing for us as well.
Yes. Thank you.
I thank you very much.
So we will...
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Eric Edelman, student and colleague of the great French spiritual teacher Arnaud Desjardins, who with his wife Sophie operates Ashram Mangalam in Quebec, Canada. Well, that's all the time we have for the Mystical Positivist this week. Next week, our guest by phone will be Ken Berhock-Cohen. Berhock is the author of the critically acclaimed classic, Honoring the Medicine, The Essential Guide to Native American Healing. Is a health educator, a traditional healer, and scholar of indigenous medicine. He is a recipient of the Alice and Elmer Green Award for Innovation and Lifetime Achievement in Energy Medicine. Also best known for his pioneering work in Chinese healing arts, Qigong, he has followed the Red Road of Native American wisdom as his personal spiritual path for 30 years. So we expect that to be a great conversation. We've had Ken on the show before talking about his Qigong work, so this is his other hat. So that show will be Saturday, February 16th, 2013. Upcoming on the spiritual calendar, the Renewal of Presence Practice Group with the Tayu Meditation Center staff will be meeting Tuesday at 7:30 p.m., February 12th, at Mini Rivers Books and Tea, 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. In a couple of weeks, we'll have another session of Opening to Insight Meditation and Discussion with Nick Egan, founder of Advaya Institute and Nyingma Lineage teacher, as well as sometimes co-host on The Mystical Positivist. And on Thursday evening, February 14th, that's Valentine's Day, we'll have Valentine Tarot readings at Mini Rivers Books and Tea as part of the Thursdays at Mini Rivers series with Cooch and Victor Daniels, co-authors of Tarot d'Amour. Give yourself and your date, partner, spouse, or friend a unique Valentine's experience by stopping by for tea and an insightful tarot reading with Cooch or Victor Daniels, co-authors of Tarot d'Amour. To help you find answers to your questions about love, they will be offering short readings that focus on questions of the heart. If you want to know how to kindle the flames of romance, what to do when falling in or out of love, or have compatibility concerns, your most urgent questions will be put in the tarot's spotlight. Adventurous or prudent, advice given on by these local authors is offered to fine-tune insights and clear the path of life's enjoyment. Cooch Daniels is a professional reader who has given many thousands of tarot readings. Victor Daniels taught psychology at SSU for 4 decades and has also given many readings. Together they wrote Tarot d'Amour and Matrix Meditations. Cows Community Radio thanks SolarWorks for the generous support. State rebates and tax credits reduce the cost of your photovoltaic systems. For more information, see them online at solarworksca.com. In gratitude for their support, Cows Community Radio acknowledges Reverie Linens. Reverie Linens offers imported European linens and towels, as well as bamboo sleepwear and loungewear. They offer gift items and a very large selection of quilts and coverlets. Reverie Linens is located at 2402 McGowan Drive in Santa Rosa, California. For more information, call them at area code 707-544-3252 or email them at reverieml@comcast.net. The Songbird Hospital will help you with advice about injured or sick songbirds. For more information, go to www.songbirdhospital.org or call area code 707-484-6502. And this is a reminder that Cows Community Radio is membership supported, so you can become a field member for $25 a year, hay bale member for $40 a year, or Cows Barn member for $60 a year. And help keep this station on the air. Everyone associated with the station works on a volunteer basis, but there are real costs to keeping quality radio from West Sonoma County operating, so we need your help to become a member of the herd. Thank you for joining.